Welcome back to Southeast Asia Radio. This week, we'll cover Taylor Swift in Singapore, the drop of the ringgit in Malaysia, and the state of the opposition in Indonesia and Thailand. I'm Lauren Mai. Today is March 21st, 2024. And on today's interview...
This ASEAN summit for Australia, I think, was really part of Australia's overall push that they've been making to enhance relationships all across the Indo-Pacific, sort of increasing their network of partners, if you will. And it's important to remember that although Australia is ASEAN's oldest dialogue partner, as you mentioned, you know, in recent years, Australia's been lagging a lot in their economic engagement, specifically with ASEAN, and focused potentially on, you could say, on other areas of Indo-Pacific.
This week, Greg and Alina hosted Catherine Pack to discuss the recent ASEAN-Australia special summit. Before that, let's start with the headlines. Good afternoon, Japhet. We have a lot on today's agenda.
Hi, Lauren. That we do. This first headline story we have is for all our Swifties tuning into Southeast Asia Radio.
Taylor Swift has been making big waves in Southeast Asia recently as she brought her Eras Tour to Singapore in early March.
Her six consecutive shows brought in fans from all over Southeast Asia, ultimately boosting Singapore's GDP, economists predict.
It's honestly been insane. Like, I've seen multiple of my friends from Southeast Asia going all the way to Singapore for this concert, from the Philippines to Indonesia, and it's crazy how this is making the news.
Swifty dedication is really something to admire.
In the first quarter growth forecast for Singapore's economy, the national GDP expanded by 2.9%, an estimated 0.2% of what was attributable to Taylor Swift's shows.
The six-day event added some 300 to 400 million Singapore dollars to the city-state's economy in the first quarter.
Her shows carried benefits to Singapore's hospitality, food and beverage, and retail activities, as 70% of the over 300,000 fans who attended the show flew in from outside of Singapore.
Wow. It looks like Taylor's multi-million dollar deal with Singapore to perform there only proved to be beneficial to its economy.
Absolutely. Singapore's comparatively small investment of 12 to 18 million USD in return for a 300 million to 400 million Singapore dollar economic boost seems like a good trade-off to me.
It really does. Good for them. But unfortunately, not every Southeast Asian country has been witnessing positive economic trends.
For our next headline, we turn to Malaysia, where the ringgit has fallen to its lowest level since the Asian financial crisis more than two decades ago.
Right. In late February, the currency was trading almost at 4.8 against the US dollar, marking a more than 4% drop this year already.
But why is this happening?
It's a whole combination of factors. Malaysia is experiencing poor export performance. Meanwhile, rising US interest rates and domestic political uncertainties don't help the situation either.
Externally, the currency is also impacted by China's slower than expected economic recovery and global economic disruptions from wars in Ukraine and the Middle East.
To make it worse, there's the recent slide in global oil prices and an upcoming EU ban on palm oil, which is further putting Malaysia's economy at risk.
But how's the government responding to all of this?
Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim called the decline concerning, but under control. At a financial event, he emphasized that the overall situation is positive, especially when considering record-high approved investments last year.
Malaysia's second finance minister, Amir Hamzah Azizan, said that the ringgit is expected to strengthen against the dollar as the U.S. ends rate hikes.
Oh, good.
The Anwar administration is also pushing to reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar by more actively asserting the ringgit in trade and investment.
A top finance ministry official said Malaysia's central bank is prepared to defend the ringgit by selling some dollar reserves.
Looking forward, authorities say that they expect growth in global trade and increased Malaysian exports to improve the financial situation.
Yes, it very much looks like the administration is crossing its fingers for these initiatives and rhetorical reassurances to work.
Already, Malaysians are paying more for staples and imported goods. If the ringgit slips any further, we could see an increase in public discontent and further damage to an already fragile political coalition.
We'll have to keep a lookout. Seems interesting. For our next story, though, we're moving on to Indonesia. Presidential candidate Anies Baswedan plans to file a case at the country's constitutional court, contesting the results of the February 14th election.
Last week, he announced his plans to reporters, but he didn't provide more details.
Indonesia's National Election Commission is expected to announce the official results of the elections by March 20th. Unofficial results show that Defense Minister Prabowo Subianto won the presidential election with nearly 60% of the votes.
Throughout the presidential race, Anies was vocal about what he described as irregularities in the months leading up to the election, hinting toward the massive distribution of social assistance given in key electoral regions.
Anies' fellow presidential candidate Ganjar Pranowo has also discussed launching a parliamentary investigation into alleged election violations and the government's conduct leading up to the election.
We'll certainly have to keep an eye out for the evolution of this case against Prabowo's win.
We will. Let's move on to our last story, though. We're watching recent developments in Thailand's political parties. As Indonesia's opposition figures fight for their share of the pie in the aftermath of the election, Thailand's opposition is fighting simply to keep its seat at the table.
On March 12th, the Election Commission of Thailand said that it would seek to dissolve the Move Forward Party, the reformist opposition party that won the most seats in the May 2023 general election.
MFP won in 2023 with a progressive platform that explicitly sought to upend the military and business establishment, including pledges to break up business monopolies and ending military conscription.
Back in May, military and business elites in the military-appointed Senate quickly moved to block the party from gaining control of parliament and excluded it from the coalition that took power.
MFP leader Pitau Limjaroenrat also faced charges of breaking election rules and a ban from politics, though he was cleared by the Constitutional Court on January 24th.
The events of the last 2 weeks are just the latest developments of a longer MFP saga.
Yeah. The commission will now ask the Constitutional Court to disband the MFP on the grounds that it has campaigned to amend Thailand's strict lèse majeste laws.
These laws, outlined under Article 112 of the Thai Criminal Code, criminalizes critical components about the Thai monarchy, but has been applied vaguely and broadly in recent years.
The request, based on an apparently unanimous decision, follows a January 31st Constitutional Court ruling that MFP's anti-lèse majeste promises constitute an attempt to overthrow the monarchy.
The ruling also ordered MFP to stop communicating the anti-lèse majeste policies, and so the MFP official website dropped it from the platform.
In a response to the court ruling, an MFP spokesperson said that the party has no intention to overthrow the democratic system, and is only seeking to prevent the law from being misused.
The party will now prepare to prove their innocence in court, but a history of ill-fortuned opposition parties in Thailand suggests that things won't be looking so great for MFP anytime soon.
No, it really doesn't. Well, those were our headlines. Up next, Greg and Alina's interview with Catherine Pack, so stay tuned.
Welcome back to another episode of Southeast Asia Radio. I'm Greg Poling with CSIS, joined as ever by co-host Alina Noor with the Carnegie Endowment. Hey, Alina.
Hey, Greg.
And today we're joined by a colleague at CSIS, Catherine Peck. Catherine is a senior fellow with our Australia chair, and in a previous life was director on the National Security Council for Southeast Asia and the Pacific Islands. We brought Catherine on to talk about the recently concluded Australia-ASEAN Commemorative Summit. Catherine sits at a unique juncture of Australia, Southeast Asia, and U.S. policy. So Catherine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So for those who didn't follow ASEAN Week in Australia, and if you're not in Australia, I imagine maybe you didn't, Australia is ASEAN's oldest dialogue partner. And to celebrate the 50th anniversary of ties, they just had a week-long series of meetings with most of the heads of government or heads of state from across Southeast Asia in Canberra. That took place from March, I think, 1st to 8th, included a big maritime cooperation forum and a whole bunch of bilateral announcements and speeches that made the press. So, Catherine, why don't we just start with a baseline? What was your biggest takeaways from ASEAN Week in Australia?
Yeah, so this is, you know, this ASEAN summit for Australia, I think, was really part of Australia's overall push that they've been making to enhance relationships all across the Indo-Pacific, sort of increasing their network of partners, if you will. And it's important to remember that although Australia is ASEAN's oldest dialogue partner, as you mentioned, you know, in recent years, Australia's been lagging a lot in their economic engagement, specifically with ASEAN, and focused potentially on, you could say, on other areas of Indo-Pacific. So I think the main goals here for Prime Minister Albanese was really twofold. One was to enhance the overall relationship, including economic relationship. And the other was to bolster Australia's own security by enhancing this relationship with these important Southeast Asia partners. And in that context, I think this summit was markedly a success.
I saw, was it a tweet by our friend, Greg, Aaron Connolly, about this should be a lesson for all other ASEAN dialogue partners on how to do a commemorative event right. Catherine, you were in Australia yourself. What was the mood like?
Yeah, so I was in Canberra, and of course, the summit was happening in Melbourne, but everyone was tracking it pretty closely. Overall, mood was good. I think there was an understanding, you know, there's always an understanding when you're meeting with ASEAN partners that there's a certain way that that relationship should be approached, obviously in a careful way, both showing the engagement and the importance of those relationships in and of themselves, but also understanding that most of these countries are very much balancing in the region and in trying to be careful with their relationships with the large partners of US and China. So I think Australia walked that line quite well in looking to enhance its overall relationship.
You were in Canberra while the ASEAN leaders were in Melbourne. I was in Canberra a week and a half earlier when Taylor Swift was in Melbourne. I'm curious which one the city considered more important.
I would hazard a guess on that one. And it might not be the one that foreign policy watchers would prefer.
So more seriously, how much do you think from Australia's perspective, this was most important to let the region know that the Australian government is serious about recommitting? And how much of this was, I suppose, for domestic politics to let the Australian public and Australian government know that this is a top priority and that Southeast Asia embraces it, wants more Australian engagement?
Yeah, that's a really good point, the domestic piece there. So both, I would say, were very important, of course. And again, the ways in which the Albanese government approached this summit and the types of deliverables they had were clearly aimed at showing the importance of Southeast Asia to Australia. But that domestic piece shouldn't be underestimated, I think. You know, this is a time when Australia is really having to look at its role as a middle power in the Indo-Pacific. They're coming off of a couple of years of some pretty significant economic coercion from China. The AUKUS deal with the US and the UK are moving forward. And all of those things require quite a bit of domestic support for government actions. And so increasing domestic awareness of these relationships in Southeast Asia and the overall security situation in Southeast Asia and the Indo-Pacific is really important.
All right, so I'll bring it up. One of the headlines that we saw coming out of the summit was the stark juxtaposition between the positions of Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim from Malaysia and President Marcos Jr. on China and the South China Sea. So on the one hand, you had Anwar saying, Malaysia doesn't have a problem with China, stop imposing your issues with China onto us. And on the other hand, you had President Marcos Jr. saying, we need to stand together in defense of the rule of law against China's assertive moves, if not aggression, in the South China Sea. What do you make of that, Catherine?
Yeah, that was really interesting and surprising on both sides, I think, to see how strong both of those leaders came out in their respective ways. You know, the Malaysia comments, the Prime Minister's comments, not completely unexpected, I think, perhaps in that context, a little surprising, especially given some of Chinese actions against the Philippines during the summit itself in the South China Sea. And so while that was going on, to hear this sort of cognitive empathy take from Anwar was a bit surprising. But again, that is what we have in ASEAN itself, right? It is some vast differences between the ways these countries look at their relationships. And Malaysia has a very strong economic relationship with China, and it's trying to protect that and walk that middle line. And that's the way that it is doing so. In Philippines' case, Marcos has been a real surprise, I think, since he's been in power. You know, our relationship with the U.S. and the Philippines has increased markedly in the last few years, much more than I think any of us would have seen or expected. And that's been largely a result of the Philippines coming out much more strongly against these Chinese actions in the South China Sea. And I saw Marcos's speech to Parliament specifically as a way of trying to energize the Australian system and remind the Australian system that, yes, ASEAN is, you know, you have to be careful when approaching ASEAN and talking to ASEAN as a whole, but we middle powers really have agency and there's a real need for us to step up, and really encouraging, I saw, Australia to take a leadership role in continuing to have those security cooperation relationships with these countries. So I thought that was a really bold move by Marcos with Parliament, and he continued to hammer that point home during the entire summit.
I'm so glad that Alina brought it up so I don't have to constantly look like the hawk on the podcast. But I mean, you're right, the juxtaposition was, it almost became a microcosm, I think, of some of the tensions in Philippine foreign policy vis-a-vis ASEAN right now, and some of the frustrations that certain ASEAN members, including Malaysia, have about what they view as the Philippines going too far and involving outside parties. But if you're the Philippines, you know, this was a reiteration of why you need the outside parties, because you get, you know, March 4th, Anwar makes a speech saying China's our friend and there's no reason for us to have any tensions in the South China Sea. And then a day later, a Chinese Coast Guard vessel hits a Philippine vessel with a water cannon that blows the windshield out, injuring four Philippine sailors, including an admiral in the Philippine Navy. And so the play in the Philippine press is, unsurprisingly, you know, Marcos bats for outside support from like-minded allies like Australia, because ASEAN is feckless, or at least certain members of ASEAN are feckless and are never going to give the Philippines the backing that it requires.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I think the Philippines is leaning far forward from the other ASEAN members. You know, if you look at the South China Sea wording in the joint statement, for example, with ASEAN, incredibly weak, incredibly watered down. In fact, I found that interesting that the joint statement in this ASEAN summit was even a little weaker than the foreign ministerial statement that ASEAN foreign ministers put out in December, which said they were closely watching with concern the activities in the South China Sea, whereas this time it just said noting the foreign minister's statement. So the frustration that the Philippines has with the current ASEAN system and that methodology of consensus is certainly palpable, and we could see that very loud and clear.
I mean, is that diplomatic speak for, okay, it's noted in the ASEAN foreign minister statement, let's just move on with other things, or do you think there was more to it, Catherine, by not specifically mentioning that phrase, concern?
That's how I saw it. You know, noted, and I've been involved in some of these negotiations of joint statements, noted is definitely a way to not outwardly say that you agree with something. We've had countries note certain resolutions in the UN that they don't necessarily agree with, just as a way to placate the other side. So I saw that word of noted and the elimination of the word with concern really noticeable in this foreign minister statement or in the joint statement.
I had a discussion with a representative of another ASEAN state last week, and I asked, okay, so in theory, is there anything that China could do to the Philippines that would actually result in an ASEAN statement of condemnation or overt support for the Philippines? And I mean, I think the answer is killing some Filipinos, maybe, but even that, if not entirely clear, would result in an ASEAN statement that's anything more than we've seen for the last 10 years. And so if you're Manila, this is the logical choice. This is, by making no decision, this is a decision that other ASEAN members have made, that the Philippines has to go outside the organization in search of support. And if that weakens ASEAN centrality, well, that's a decision that other ASEAN members have made. Not to make this a South China Sea episode, because it wasn't meant to be, but that is what a lot of the plot lines, I think, became in both Australia and in Southeast Asian markets.
I mean, I think the other interesting juxtaposition was, and we can certainly talk more about the South China Sea issue, but I thought the other interesting contrast was between Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong's welcome of AUKUS, even volunteering to host nuclear-powered submarines when they're ready in Singapore at the Changi Naval Base, and former Prime Minister Paul Keating's lashing out at his own government. That was super interesting, don't you think, Catherine?
Completely agree. And I think it's also notable that Keating was fairly isolated in that view. We did not see any other people coming out with support. In fact, there was even several officials that, you know, note that they are friends of and greatly respect the former prime minister, but do not agree with his views there. So I think that viewpoint is increasingly limited in the Australian system. And it was clear to see from the reaction. But I do think it was very interesting to see not just Prime Minister Lee, but then also, you know, later Marcos himself made some positive comments about AUKUS. So kind of turning this from, no, this is not some consensus ASEAN view against AUKUS, to this is a much more nuanced situation. And we're seeing that countries in ASEAN that are much more keyed in on the reality of the security situation are much more welcoming of initiatives like AUKUS.
Kevin, do you think that this will help put the domestic debate in Australia to bed a little bit? Because last year we saw the kind of intra-party debate within Labour, where those who opposed AUKUS were clearly in the minority and were allowed to voice their grievances, but then badly lost in the party convention vote in support of AUKUS. And then you've still had Keating and a few other non-government types out there saying this puts Australia at odds with Asia, or at least Southeast Asia. But other than Malaysia and parts of the Indonesian system, I would argue a minority of the Indonesian system, you've actually heard far more support from the region than you've heard overt opposition. And for a lot of countries, I think you've just heard kind of nothing or ambiguity. So having these speeches in Melbourne, I wonder if that finally makes it so that certain Australian officials don't take it upon themselves to speak for ASEAN. They've now heard ASEAN voices on AUKUS, and they're largely salutary.
You know, I think it may take away that argument for those within the Australian system, but I don't necessarily think that ASEAN voices and ASEAN opinions are really informing that much of the internal debate within Australia on AUKUS and on the broader geopolitical reality of today. AUKUS is a really, it's an interesting debate within the Australian system right now. To quote my colleague, Charlie Adele, the support within Australia is very broad, but very shallow across the system, meaning that there's not, beyond talking about it as a jobs program and very peripherally some of the openings of potential bases and areas, it hasn't really been pushed by the government and by people across the spectrum to really gain that deep support in the system right now. And you got to remember, just like America or anywhere else, most of the political debate still happens around domestic issues, vice external issues. So I don't think, honestly, that ASEAN's opinion or the different ASEAN states' opinion is really going to affect the Australian debate that much.
To be fair, Greg, it's like, what, 2 countries out of 10 in ASEAN that have said something fairly favorable about AUKUS? So I don't know if that marks any changing sentiment within ASEAN.
Anyway, 2 presidents. But, you know, we've heard Prabowo as defense minister publicly endorse AUKUS, so you can assume where he stands when he becomes president in October. And we all know that Vietnam is quite supportive, just not in public. So I would argue that other than Malaysia, we really haven't heard any head of government in Southeast Asia oppose AUKUS. And we've heard far more support than we have opposition.
I'd agree with Greg on that. I think also just the fact that it's we've seen a dampening of some of the concern around AUKUS as well as some of the misinformation about nuclear and other issues start to be, you know, rectified across the region. So I do think there is a reduction overall in any consternation about AUKUS, and whether it's an increase in support or not, I think there it's less of an issue across ASEAN.
I mean, yeah, I would agree it's less of an issue now simply because I think there are a lot of details that need to be finalized and sorted out even within Australia itself. So there hasn't been very much news to be consternated about, I guess. But Greg, you mentioned Prabowo. Indonesia, the largest country in Southeast Asia, was at the summit, but you rarely heard any reporting about Indonesia's position on any of the issues at the summit. Is that fair, or is that just, you know, an unfair representation of what media was reporting from the summit, Catherine?
I also did not see a whole lot, which was surprising to me, again, given Indonesia's spot as 4th largest country in the world and just the powerhouse that they are going to become economically and the fact that there's so much of an economic focus to this summit. So I'm also quite surprised by that.
One country that did get its own moment in the spotlight was Vietnam, with the signing of the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership after the summit formally ended. So on March, or I think it was after it ended, on March 7th, they inked it, which means that Vietnam and the U.S. formally raised their diplomatic relationship to a CSP, Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, during President Biden's visit last September. And then Australia immediately said, we want one too. The Japanese got theirs first, I think, so now Australia comes next. So now we have, I don't know, how do you want to read this? All 4 Quad members have CSPs. Every U.S. treaty ally in Asia, except for the Philippines, has a CSP. You know, however you dice this, it sure looks like Vietnam is making a concerted effort to rally like-mindeds in support, raising them all to the highest echelons of its diplomatic hierarchy. I mean, how do you view this?
Yeah, concur, especially given the older CSPs with China and Russia clearly cast a different light on that level of relationship. And then expanding that relationship with the U.S. and then Japan and now Australia, much more like-minded countries with the U.S. here, like you said, Quad nations, including India, I think clearly demonstrates the way that Vietnam, in its careful way, is trying to continue to both stay in good enough graces with China, but also push back in their own way in terms of what's happening. Like you mentioned on AUKUS, I think we have a clear idea of where Vietnam probably sits on that, but they're never going to say it outright. They're going to do things like this and upgrade. I also thought it was interesting that as part of the CSP with Australia, they're going to have an annual dialogue on minerals and diversifying supply chains, which, you know, that's a key area where Australia can really contribute in the region to the energy transition and a lot of the supply chain issues that everybody's dealing with. And so enhancing that relationship with Vietnam, I thought was really key.
One thing that stood out to me from the summit was the absence of any regional discussion on cybersecurity, particularly given how strong Australia has been in supporting capacity building efforts within Southeast Asia on that particular issue. I know there were some side arrangements and agreements done with different countries, but as an ASEAN-Australia convening, there wasn't that topic discussed. Any thoughts on that, Catherine? And if not, what's next after all this fanfare? It was like this giant party for a week. I had FOMO just looking at all the photos on social media.
I know it's going to be hard to top this one, I think. And like you said at the beginning, it's sort of a playbook for how the rest of the dialogue partners should run their special summit. So take note, US, I think. I don't have a good answer on the cybersecurity. I do think that's pretty interesting, perhaps, you know, just with the economic engagement and the investment and the other big announcements. Australia was going to do, you know, only had so much bandwidth to have big agreements with ASEAN as a whole. But you're right, that was a little bit lacking.
Let's lighten things up a little bit. Gaza, there was a fair amount of discussion. And it did end up in the joint statement. And it was in the joint statement in a pretty clear and uncompromising way. All parties calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. And yet we also had, as part of Anwar's speech, you know, condemnation of the West overall, which I assume in the minds of most ASEAN states includes Australia. You know, Anwar said that I think the word was that the West gives an unconditional blank check to anything Israel does. Gaza, does Australia have more space maybe to distinguish its position on Gaza than the U.S. does in a way that can maybe benefit Australia's relationship? Because I don't really think it's hurting the U.S. in most of Southeast Asia, but the opinion polling we do have so far does suggest that we are seeing a pretty nasty impact for support for the U.S. in Malaysia and Brunei, and maybe a more modest downturn in Indonesia because of perceived U.S. support for Israel.
Yeah, this is a complicated one in Australian domestic politics, as it is in the U.S. and others. I mean, Australia has been fairly supportive of Israel through this event. And as if I remember correctly, and correct me if I'm wrong, I do believe that Australia had proposed language regarding the returning of hostages that was taken out. So I saw this as a little bit of a compromise on Australia's part in order to potentially get wording elsewhere that they wanted and sort of a middle ground that they were willing to accept. I'm not sure, short of, you know, making a real break with the U.S. and others and even its own policy on Israel, that they would have much space to gain ground with, as you said, you know, Malaysia and some others that clearly see this as a very different issue than the Australian government does. So that's going to continue to probably be a little bit of a thorn in the side of Australia, as it is with the U.S. with some of these partners.
I think Australia's position has also been shifting, though, over the months and how, particularly since the level of damage and destruction and lives lost, killed really in Gaza, really changed the equation around the world. And so Australia has, in fact, distinguished itself from the U.S. position in calling for a ceasefire much earlier. And so I think that contributed to maybe the government Canberra's willingness to accede to some of the language that was proposed that resulted in, you know, the agreement to a ceasefire in the summit document.
Yeah, it certainly allowed them to go that direction where the U.S. wouldn't have been able to.
I am curious if we start to see more distinction in the language used by regional governments when talking about this, because it's not just Australia. Europe has generally also embraced the idea of an immediate unconditional ceasefire in a way that the U.S. has not thus far. Even though I do think the U.S. position has clearly shifted, as evidenced by President Biden's State of the Union address, the U.S. is never going to have the political space to go that far. But I haven't seen any real disambiguation yet in statements from Malaysian or Indonesian or any other leaders in the region saying the U.S. is doing X, whereas we're okay with what Australia and Europe's doing. It still tends to be the West. The West is backing Israel. And I suspect that Australia would very much like to see that disambiguated and just be the U.S. is doing X and Australia, you're fine.
Yeah, agree.
One other issue that we should cover, Catherine, you noted at the top that Australia's economic engagement in the region has really been lagging behind its stated strategic focus on engaging Southeast Asia. What did the Albanese government do to try to correct that at the summit?
This is a pretty huge gap between what Australia has been saying verbally about its relationship with Southeast Asia and the reality. You know, in recent years, Australia investment, I think, in New Zealand is more than its investment in all of Southeast Asia. When you look at the population numbers, I mean, that just makes no sense. So Albanese recognizing this as part of the summit announcing announceables, he announced a $2 billion Southeast Asia investment financing facility. And that was committed by the Australian government. Pretty huge commitment there and a pretty huge statement of where the Albanese government sees that Australia really needs to go with Southeast Asia into the future.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. Alina, thank you as always for help making me sound more coherent than I am. And Catherine, thank you so much for taking the time. Thanks all of you for listening. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with another episode of Southeast Asia Radio.
Thanks again for joining us for this episode of Southeast Asia Radio. Write us with any comments, questions, or feedback at searadio@csis.org, and we'll get back to you.
Do us a favor and subscribe and give us a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whatever streaming platform you listen to us on. Tell your friends about us.
Marla Hiller is our producer, and our interns are Angus Lamb, Corey Donnelly, and Tappy Fung. Our co-hosts today were Greg Poling and Alina Noor. My name is Jaffet Kitson.
And I'm Lauren Mai.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks for another episode of Southeast Asia Radio.